I'm going to try to go some into chapter 5, I believe, anyway. Belshazzar, the king, made a feast to thousands of the Lord and drank wine before the thousands. And Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the gold and the silver vessels which the father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem. And the king and his princes and the wives and concubines might drink of them. Now, as we said before, Nabonidus had probably gone away somewhere else. You see, Belshazzar and his dad was reigning together at this time. History tells us that he went to go to another city to build it up, to beautify another city. And evidently, this feast was to celebrate the success of Belshazzar's dad. You know, people throw parties for just about any reason they can think of. You really don't have to have a reason to throw a party. I feel as I read this that Belshazzar was a spoiled brat that had turned to be an alcoholic, and he was a very weak ruler. He drank consistently, as history tells us. So here is something to celebrate, so let's all get drunk. And so all of them, all the who's who of Babylon, were there in the banquet room drinking out of the cup that should have been God's. These vessels belonged to the God of heaven. They didn't belong to Belshazzar. His grandfather brought those vessels there as a treasure, not to use, not to drink out of. This was never his purpose. They were just the fact that they were made out of silver and gold. But to use these, to actually drink out of these, where only God's priest was to drink, was a mockery. So again, now we go back and pick up time. This approximately, chapter 5, was approximately 30 some odd years after 4 ends. Probably 65 years after chapter 1. Or something similar to that. I didn't figure up the full time. We could very easily. Anyway, they brought them in and all of them drank wine, verse 4, and praised the gods of gold and silver and brass and iron and wood and stone. There's 6 of these mentioned here in verse 4. 6 is the number of man, all the way through prophetic language. So here's the God of men, and we see that today. These are the gods that men worship, gods of materialism. And look upon that. If you study the 9th chapter of Revelation, verse 20, and I'm not going to go into that, and also the 19th chapter of the 18th chapter of Revelation, you'll find that all their gods was a god of materialism. So it is here. And they praise these gods. Then in verse 5, and the same are who gave forth fingers of man's hand and wrote against the candlestick on the plaster of the wall and the king's palace, and the king saw part of the hand that wrote him. What if you see something like that? Where else do we read where a finger wrote something? 20th chapter of Exodus, God wrote the Ten Commandments, didn't he, with his finger, the first one. So I think we're in both cases, we can see them identified with judgment, because the breaking of the law was definitely a time of judgment. God wrote this in the light of the candlestick. I feel that this candlestick was also a candlestick that came out of the sanctuary in Jerusalem. This is God's light, in the light of God's light. When we think of Saul on the road to Damascus, the sign of God was the light that came out of heaven and blinded him. God's light enlightens his word. It enlightens his purpose. His light shine out of darkness, shone into our heart. We could think of so many things that this candle stick represents, or this lampstand. It was on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw it. And the king's countenance changed. Seemed like he must have sobered up in a hurry, in verse 6. And fear came upon him, and his joints were loosed like water. and his knees smote one against another. Did you ever be so afraid that you shook? Well, you ever been so afraid that your knee? First sermon I preached, I was like that. My knees actually hit each other, I think. But this is the essence of fear. And the king cried aloud. I would have too. I'd have cried real loud. To bring in the astrologers and the Chaldeans and all of these falsities. We read in verse 7. The false ones that don't know the answers. And how often we read of that through here. And the promises that he gave them of wealth and all these things. But no matter what the promises was, they could not interpret. They could interpret their... Not from their gods they couldn't anyway, could he? It took our God to make an interpretation. Then was Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. How angry he must have come. He's troubled on every side. Now, the queen in verse 10 was no doubt his mother. His wife probably wasn't any older than Belshazzar and probably didn't know too much about Daniel either. No doubt his mother did. And I feel that this was not his wife in verse 10. But by reason of the words of the king and the lords came into the banquet house. This news must have spread. I imagine everyone got frightened in this. And probably the king's lords and they went throughout the place telling, and the queen got heard of it. And so she came to the banquet house and began to talk to the king. And she said in verse 11, there is a man. Oh, thank God that God always has a man on the scene that knows him. There's never been a time where the man has been completely without spiritual guidance in any way. There is a man of thy kingdom, whom the spirit of the holy gods and in the days of thy father's light and under understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him whom King Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. This is what's hard to understand, is why they didn't call him first if he was the master of them. Well, if you read a little farther, it seemed like that Belshazzar didn't even know he existed. And then verse 12, I enjoyed reading this because this is a wonderful commendation for Daniel. And then in verse 13, they brought Daniel in before the king. He kind of acted like he knew him, and yet he knew he didn't. He said, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captives of Judah, whom the king my father sought out of jewelry? This is kind of an irony statement, trying to a put-down statement. Maybe I should put it that way. I don't know why I called you in here. You're just one of those children of the captives. You're a Jew. You're not a Chaldean. You're a Jew. I've heard of you, verse 14, that the spirit of the God is in thee. And I doubt if he heard him before his mother told him about it. The spirit of God is in thee, and the light of the understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. Now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought before me, and they could not, they should read the writings. Anyway, they couldn't do it. They couldn't make the interpretation. And then the second time, he said, I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if thou canst read the writings, I'm going to give you all these fine gifts I promised them. And then Daniel answered and said, let your gifts to be yourself. He didn't want their gifts. You know, God's real people isn't after money. They're after spiritual conditions. Now, everybody knows that it takes money to do things. But this is secondary or even third or fourth down the line. And Daniel didn't want his gifts. He had no need for these gifts. And besides that, Daniel knew that it wasn't going to last very long anyway. He couldn't use these gifts very long because he already had the interpretation of it. Verse 18. Well, first he gave him a sermon. You know, people don't always ask for sermons. They don't really like it when they get one. But Daniel gave it to him anyway. And we read part of this sermon before. Thou, O King, the Most High God, gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father the kingdom and all that he had done for him. And when his pride was lifted up, verse 20, which we've already talked about, what God did about it. You know, Then verse 22, "And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, not humble thy heart, though thou knowest this." You knew about Nebuchadnezzar and what God did. He might have not been too old at the time, but he knew about it nevertheless. And you refused to humble your heart concerning, you know, people sometimes just don't learn, do they? And then in verse 22 is the real indictment against Belshazzar. "But thou lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven." That's a terrible thing to do. Then the second, and they have brought the vessels of the house before thee. And thou and thy lords and thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine from them. So there's four basic indictment here in this verse against Belshazzar. That they praised while they were drinking out of these vessels, they praised other gods. And so this was a terrible situation. He lifted himself up above God. They drank, they used the vessels. They drank of the vessels and they praised other gods with the vessels. Then was part of the hand from him and the writing of the hand. And this is the writing that was written, "Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." This is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered the kingdom and finished it. This is it. God isn't going to stand for this foolishness anymore. Tekel, thou art weighed in the balance and found wanting. God's judgment is fair and honest. All things were weighed and he come up short. Phrixus, thy kingdom is divided and given into the Medes and the Persians. This word is actually a conjunction. It joined the Medes and the Persians that God had divided the kingdom into. So just by the word, he knew. Now, Revelation told him it was the Medes and the Persians. He would have never known this because God had to tell him this was future. And so Belshazzar commanded that all these gifts, verse 29, be given unto him. This is about the shortest reign we have of anybody, I guess, because that very night, and that night, was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. And Darius, the Medes, took the kingdom, being about 62 years old when they came in and took it. So God's timing is always absolutely perfect, and he knows how to do it. Now, we said that this city was an inconquerable city. It was double-walled, heavy gates, and nothing. But when God has a time to do something, he does it. Here's the history of what happened. According to history, two drunken guards that was guarding the main gate staggered out, opened the gate and staggered out, and they were captured by Mede soldiers. And they were taken and compelled to tell the layout of the city and what the city looked like and everything. And so they simply changed the course of the river around. Two or three of the soldiers came in the river, went around, unlocked the main gates, and all the soldiers came in. It was so simple. There was no war. There was no battle. Everybody was drunk. And you talk about false security, that they had it, depending upon the thing. So it was real, real simple of how God brought this to pass. How God can make the impossible possible. But it's in his time. 70 years, Jeremiah said. 67, I believe it is, years had expired at this time. We'll read later on that Daniel sees it when the 70 years under another rule. But all of this pictures now the kingdoms of this earth, their intoxication with materialistic things and how they get intoxicated. But God is going to change things. He has everything in order. And in God's due time, he's going to, in all simplicity, he's going to conquer these world nations.